New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Our topic today is Andrea Puharic, the great parapsychologist who died in 1995, and his space kids. With me today in the studio here in Albuquerque is one of those individuals who was one of Puharic's space kids, Heidi Yerka. Heidi is the author of a new book called The Making of a Psychic, and she has come to Albuquerque all the way from Virginia to be here today. Welcome, Heidi.
Thank you so much. Lovely to be with you.
It's a pleasure to be with you as well. And I should say, for the benefit of our viewers, although we've only met recently, really this year, and it's still February, early or mid-February, to be fair. But I knew your aunt.
That's right.
Your aunt Edith Yerka was a good friend of mine. I stayed at her apartment in New York City decades ago. She was actively involved in the Intuition Network, a nonprofit organization that I ran. In fact, she was our keynote speaker for one of our events.
Ah. Yeah, she was big in the Dowsing Society, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I met her at a convention of the Psychotronics Society. So she had a deep interest in the paranormal during the time that I knew her, although she was a psychiatrist, a mainstream, well-respected New York psychiatrist. And interestingly, she was also a good friend of Andrea Puharic, about whom we'll be talking today.
That's true. It changed her life.
She lived near him in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
Puharic lived in Ossining.
She built a house overlooking Hudson in Croton-on-Hudson, which is right next to Ossining.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, she built another house. She sold that one and built a place up in the woods.
So even before you ever met Andrea Puharic, you could say he was a friend of your family.
Well, he was a patient of my father's. My father was his dentist. Mm-hmm. And my father would come home and just be raving about the stories he would tell him, like when he spent 2 weeks in the Egyptian pyramid overnight doing experiments, which was unheard of for the government to let people do that. Very interesting stories. So,
but before you became involved with Puharic, you had already developed a real deep interest in the psychic world.
Yes. When I was in college in California, I went to a psychic fair. I didn't really know what it was, and I had a lot of intuitive experiences as a child. And I went there, and it was a whole new world for me. And I took courses and very quickly took to it and was very comfortable with a lot of them and ended up becoming a practicing psychic who did readings and also healing work.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in my early 20s.
In your early 20s, you were deeply engaged.
Yes.
in all of this, a card-carrying psychic living in Southern California.
That's right.
And if I recall the story correctly, one morning you woke up with an inspiration like, oh, it's time to move back to New York.
That's right. And it just wouldn't go away. I had a nice little studio on the beach, and I loved my, I had a bookstore job I liked and my psychic tribe at the Psionetics, but it just wouldn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked my friend Sharon and said, this is what I'm getting. And she was intuitive and said, yeah, I see you going. I'm not sure why.
Mm-hmm.
So I called my parents and said, this is what I'm getting. And they said, sure. And within 10 days, I left.
So you found yourself back with your family in Croton-on-Hudson.
Yes.
I gather it's a lovely little village.
Yeah. really pretty. It's one of the widest points of the Hudson. It's over 3 miles across there, mm-hmm. So it's gorgeous.
And you didn't know what to do with yourself, I assume. You hadn't made any plans other than to move to New York.
Yeah, I just trusted my intuition, as they say. Mm-hmm. And within 10 days, Andre had come in to get a cleaning at the dentist office and told my father about these classes he was about to give at his home. It was the first time he'd ever done it. Mm-hmm.
What year was this?
This was 1976, in the fall of 76.
Mm-hmm. So I can report for what it's worth. I had already met Andre Apuharich and worked with him starting, if I remember correctly, around 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at the time a graduate student in Berkeley, but Apuharich in the world of parapsychologists and in that era was something of a superstar. He had written a number of books. He had written Beyond Telepathy, exploring the role of the nervous system and psychic functioning. He had written The Sacred Mushroom, one of the early books on psychedelic mushrooms. And he had written Uri. He had discovered Uri Geller. He was already famous for bringing Uri Geller to the United States. Uri Geller, for most of our viewers, a very controversial figure. Every time I mention his name, I get people who respond and say, "Don't you know about Johnny Carson? He's an absolute fraud." However, I've known Uri Geller for a long time. I just want to lay this out right now. I sponsored his first major public appearance in the United States in 1973. I've introduced him to laboratories in the physics department of the University of California. I've watched him under many circumstances. I've read many scientific papers. So don't talk to me about Johnny Carson.
Yes.
In any case, that was only one of Apuharich's many accomplishments. He had also achieved a lot of recognition for his work in Brazil with a healer named Arrigo.
Yes.
The surgeon with the rusty knife, written about in a book by John Fuller, in which Andre Apuharich was the consultant, the major person to research Arrigo. So all of that history was behind him, and more, much more.
Absolutely. He was fascinating to listen to, and he spoke so well, and he had such a welcoming demeanor, too, that you really, it was fascinating to listen to, but you also felt at ease. You didn't feel like this was someone who had something to prove, and he was going to, you know, beat you over the head with this information. It was just easy and very pleasant. We hung on every word. It was fascinating.
He was a professor of surgery, if I remember correctly, at New York University.
Yes, he was, and he was a Tesla expert.
And an inventor. He had many inventions along the lines of Tesla, working with different kinds of electrical currents and how they can affect the human organism in different ways. And as a result of that, one of his major interests, and you have to picture yourself in the 1970s when this was a big deal, had to do with ELF, extremely low frequency electromagnetic waves.
Right, based on Tesla's inventions.
Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, in that era, the Soviet Union was experimenting with these signals. We use them too, as a matter of fact, to communicate with submarines, because ELF signals could penetrate the ocean. And the Russians were sending ELF signals. They were called woodpecker signals, as I recall, all across the globe. And Andrea was very concerned about this.
Yes, he was. As was Tesla, he was reticent about introducing this to the masses, for how it would be used. It could be used for bad as well as good.
I do recall, for example, when Andrea first introduced Uri Geller to the scientific community, skeptics such as Martin Gardner wrote articles pointing out that Andrea had invented a device you would implant in a tooth, and it would serve as a radio, so you could listen to the radio through your tooth. And He had many devices like that. And so Martin Gardner said, this is obviously how Uri Geller is cheating. He's not doing telepathy. He's getting radio signals through his tooth. And Puharich was collaborating with him on that.
My memory is that originally the tooth was a hearing aid.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he, you know, finessed it in different ways. I don't know terribly a lot about that, but I remember reading about it.
And your Aunt Edith had in her home a Faraday cage, which is a cage made of with walls of copper wire, and it shields the person inside the cage from stray electromagnetic signals. They just can't get inside the Faraday cage. In fact, I interviewed Charlie Tart, another great parapsychologist who, as a young, his first work in parapsychology was an assistant to Andrea Puharich at the Round Table Foundation that he had in Maine at the time, and working with the Faraday cage as an implement for enhancing psychic functioning. And it worked. Charlie Tart was able to replicate those studies. And if I remember rightly, you and all of the space kids, young people that Puharich was gathering around him, were tested in the Faraday cage.
Yeah, we had sessions. And he had a simple kind of protocol that he did with each one so that there would be a kind of a consistent trail. And a way to later, he hoped, organize us all in doing specific types of meditations together where it would be a group vibration.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it would be fair to say that at this point in Puharich's career, he had been around the block many times in the psychic world. He had worked with Ari Goh. He had worked with Uri Geller. I gather that by the time you met him, his relationship with Uri was minimal at that point.
Yeah. Uri had moved on and was living in New York City then. They were still in touch somewhat. But, you know, Andre always had nine things going on and different interests. So he had moved on. I mean, he understood that Uri was a young man who needed to find his place in the world with his extraordinary talents. So he let him go.
And it seemed as if with the Space Kids project, Andrea was gathering around himself a group of young people, talented psychics, and I think you suggested to me earlier that he was looking perhaps for another Uri Geller.
I think so. That would have been faster than cultivating all of us who were maybe not quite as dramatic in what we presented, or something different than the nine experience that the former people around him. By the time I got there, Phyllis Schlemmer came over a few times, but that was sort of ending at that point. So it was a whole new generation of people.
You mentioned the nine, and that's legendary. I didn't even get to that when we think of all of the projects that Dr. Puharich was involved in. What do you know about the nine?
Well, I've read a lot about it. And as I said, he was doing some more sessions with Phyllis.
She was a trance channeler.
Yes, and she's had a very good book of her own, which names escape me at the moment. But he worked with her for a very long time. And different other people channeled the nine at some point. And that's all been written in books, but that was not a big part of my experience with him at that point. So we listened, but we had other things we were doing.
Well, it might be fair for our viewers who are unfamiliar with the nine to say that some people thought of them as the nine ancient deities of Egypt, ancient Egypt, and that they were also somehow associated with UFO appearances, and that they were all somehow also related to the unusual psychic abilities evidenced by Uri Geller, where there were many UFO activities, and as Andrea wrote about it, the archetypal symbol of Horus was very prominent in the work of Uri Geller. And we should also mention, even before you got involved with Puharich, he had been involved in a project that working with the channels, working with the nine, where he would travel around the world to different airports. He would like fly to Moscow and meditate inside the Moscow airport at a particular time and as specified by the channels and leave. And it was his belief that by visiting these locations and meditating at certain times and places that he was furthering the cause of world peace.
Yes. Yes. That was before I was involved, but there's some documentation about that. Mm-hmm. And they got good feedback. Yeah. And then, of course, he had his watch that would start doing things.
He had a watch that would start and stop at irregular times. And I gather he was under the impression the watch was also giving him messages from the nine.
Yes.
By its behavior. So Puharich was a legendary figure for all of these reasons. And to add to the legend, he was friends with many people in high places. I know, for example, Henry Wallace, who was the former vice president of the United States, was a friend of Puharich, came up to the Roundtable Foundation. Arthur M. Young, who was my mentor, the inventor of the Bell helicopter, was involved with Andrea Puharich. Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, was involved with Puharich and the Nine. And I tend to think that the whole Star Trek series may have been, to some degree, an outgrowth of that experience.
Well, Close Encounters was... And that was a fabulous movie.
The movie Close Encounters?
Yeah, Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
How and what was the connection there?
Michael Phillips, the producer of it, he had done some Faraday cage sessions with Andrea.
I see.
And at least Andrea told us he believed that that was his mission, was to make that movie.
So
I got to go to the premiere, which was lovely.
It was also thought by people that Puharich had been involved with the CIA and with the project known as MK Ultra, which was engaged in back in the 1950s before Timothy Leary, experimenting with psychedelic drugs and how they might affect the population.
Yeah, by the time I met him, that was over in terms of being something that he studied on a daily basis. Although down in the basement, there were jars of all these old mushrooms that it was almost like a museum. We never took them, but they were quite interesting looking. And we asked him a little bit about it. And he just, you know, by that point, this is the mid-70s, he had moved on, but it was...
So here you have this legendary figure with all of this enormous history, and he tells your father, his dentist, that he wants to offer some classes in his home, and I presume these are classes on psychic development.
Yes, metaphysics big time. Mm-hmm. The first ones were about the soul, and then he moved on to healing and the physics of telekinesis. That was a big one because, you know, it wasn't just Uri. Some of these other kids could do it. And, of course, when Uri, in the Tonight Show, he bombed, but the one he did on the BBC later that year in November, kids all over the planet at home were bending spoons and stuff. There are a lot of documentation. In fact, a person I know in Canada, when I told him about Uri, he said, "Oh, yeah, we watched that. And our forks bent and, you know, watches started and all kinds of things like that." So
I know that's the case. I had Uri on my radio show back in those days in KPFA radio in Berkeley. And we got the calls, the switchboard lit up. People were calling from all over the San Francisco Bay Area to report psychokinetic events taking place in their homes while Uri was on the radio. And so I know for a fact that those things happened. We tried to research those people as much as we could at the time. They were known as mini Gellers.
Right. Right.
And this was a worldwide phenomenon. And so I think it's quite interesting that somebody with all of this enormous history, and I'm sure I'm just sort of covering the highlights and much, much more that I haven't gotten to. I know that for a fact. And now you find yourself with your parents and your aunt,
right,
all attending these classes, what was it, once every other week or so?
And the first, there were two sessions. The first was once every week because he wasn't traveling a lot then. Mm-hmm. It was on a Thursday night or something. Yeah. And we all brought little cassette recorders, and Edith took notes in shorthand. She was a psychiatrist. She was used to doing that and filled up notebooks full of things. And that was the tape deck cassette era, so those haven't aged very well, but I still have mine.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
The original cassette tapes,
yeah.
Because obviously these days with AI, you can recover.
Well, we tried to digitize them, but the sound was really lousy on them. Yeah.
A good sound engineer might be able to fix that. In any case, the point is that this was your introduction.
Yes.
This is you sort of, one might say, walked into the lion's den.
And somehow I knew to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew that it was this calm certainty that I was going.
And it became a community of sorts.
It did. It really did.
And so in addition to your family members, there were other young people as well. And I gather they tended to have psychic gifts.
Yeah, there were scientists, and there was one guy who's a wonderful dowser, and different people, psychics, but also just a very wide range of people who had known Andrea, mm-hmm. and were just interested in this. Now, of course, this is after the Seth material came out, Jane Roberts, and all that, so people were more aware of it because she did like 15 books. And so this was not so new anymore to be open to these kind of experiences.
In fact, my recollection is, I call it the psychic 70s.
I love it.
It was a decade of psychic flourishing all across the planet.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, it was still in the aftermath of the 60s.
Right.
There was a lot of social protests going on. Psychedelics were widespread. I think you were exposed to psychedelics in California, for example.
Yeah, early on, mm-hmm. I did a little bit, and I liked the expansion I got from it, but I was always took a very low dose. Mm-hmm. I was not one of these people that wanted to be just in a chair, you know, oblivious to the world. I'd rather run around with the flowers or something and enjoy that experience.
And you probably didn't need much.
Well, back then it was pure, too, and, you know, that was when it was still coming out of these scientific labs, so...
And other people in the group had unusual talents.
Yes. Yeah. And there were the first set of what really were the space kids were younger. Some of them were 7 years old up to 12 or in teens when we first went to the classes. Mm-hmm. And so they were, the first classes were in the carriage house in the back, not in the main house, the first
He had a large estate.
Yes, beautiful. And so he tried to do a progression that wouldn't overwhelm us with each class. Mm-hmm. And he'd lecture for maybe an hour, hour and a half, and we'd have a short break. And then questions. Now, of course, every week there were so many questions that he ended up going a lot longer. And I think that's what influenced him to do the second set, mm-hmm. because we were hungry for more. And his delivery was so charming and easy to understand. And, you know, just it was a very cohesive, wonderful experience. Mm-hmm.
People have compared me to Dr. Xavier of the X-Men, maybe because I look slightly like Patrick Stewart and because of my interest in the paranormal. But actually, I think Andrea Puharich was sort of the archetypal Dr. Xavier with his space kids.
Yeah, and it's been so long now that people have kind of forgotten. You know, when I bring him up, people don't really remember him a lot of the time. And But if I mention Uri, some people do. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad the film's coming out about him, and that'll be good.
You're referring to a documentary called, if I remember correctly, Mind Traveler.
Yes.
In which you appear.
Right.
About Dr. Puharich, and my good friend Lance Mungia has been working on that documentary as an editor for it. It still hasn't yet been finalized in terms
of... Yeah, and I'm not in the loop on any of the details of that.
It's public release, but it's fair to say that when it does come out, one will expect a new push for people to recognize Puharich's significance in the history of parapsychology.
That's true. And even if you just Google his name, there's all these wonderful lectures he's given on YouTube. I mean, he's all over the place. There's one he talked about, the last invention that he was really working on, which was a device to split the water atom to run his automobile on water as a fuel. And he goes into it in great detail. I was surprised to find that on the web, and I watched it because that was after I knew him in his later years. And he was still incredibly articulate, and you could follow him easily. You know, your eyes didn't glaze over at the scientific talk. He was just a really good orator that way.
And something of a genius.
I would say so.
Now, we haven't really mentioned yet to our viewers, and maybe it's time to talk about the fire.
Okay.
It's the first chapter of your book, The Making of a Psychic. You had become quite close with Puharich. He had actually engaged you to work with him on a variety of projects. You were, amongst other things, a writer. You had done some journalistic work, and he needed editorial help, and you were there helping him, and actually you moved into his house.
I did, before the Mind Link, when we were getting ready to do all that. And when I came back, I started working for a weekly newspaper that a friend worked at. And so I was going to meetings and taking notes and writing regular community-type stuff. Mm-hmm. But because of that, and I did a little bit of that when I was in college in California, too, I could help him practice for lectures he would give. We'd practice. I would ask reporter-style questions, and he would answer. And we did it two afternoons a week, and we developed a really nice camaraderie. And during that time, he started asking me a lot of questions about my own psychic experiences, mm-hmm. and eventually determined, maybe we should do some cage work. Mm-hmm. So
that was like almost the initiation for becoming a space kid, is to get into the Faraday cage and do ESP testing.
Yeah, and of course, everyone's experience was different. But he had a loose protocol. Like the first time that you go in, you get used to doing the experience. He didn't hypnotize you or anything. You had a gentle countdown from 10 to 1 to get into a relaxed state. But the first thing that he did was he had everyone go out into their consciousness and look for the sun. And so I found this out later. He said, you know, do you see the sun? I said, yeah. And he goes, well, go closer. And I went closer, and there was this huge hole in it. And I was afraid to say anything because I was like, what? But I did. And he kind of, you know, I could hear him sort of smile and say, well, go in the hole. And there's a whole story about that after that. And of course,
go into the hole in the sun.
Yeah. So there was a progression that he wanted to see. Mm-hmm. Because he was hoping to have a cohesive group, mm-hmm. and be able to do very positive planetary things with vibration. Mm-hmm. That's the whole thing. He was all about peace. He was all about consciousness raising, helping the planet, because we were on a bad path. You know, all the weaponization, what the Russians were doing, and just man's inhumanity to man in general. Mm-hmm. And he wanted... You know, I think he was ambitious about sort of saving the planet, but we all were. You know, the Vietnam War had been over not that long ago, and everybody really wanted to focus on getting along and raising the vibration mm-hmm. of the planet.
So by virtue of moving into his house, I guess you lived on the third floor. There was a bedroom up in the attic.
Actually, there was three spaces. There was a room to the side, and that had two twin beds in it. Then there was a room in the front, which was a single, which I took. And then there was a space in the back. So when people would visit, and we had quite a few visitors, there was always somewhere for somebody to stay. Mm-hmm. But I took that. He told me about that room, and I was very happy to have a room to myself up there, and you know, I had a desk and everything. So mm-hmm.
So you were a regular part of a community that was forming at that time. And I should mention, other members of the community who you became acquainted with at that time included Carla Ruckert and Don Elkins, who were L&L was their little business, and they were channeling the Ra channels. Yes. There's a well-known book. There's all sorts of YouTube material these days about the Ra channeling, and Puharich was very close with them because the Ra channeling seemed to be somehow connected to the Nine.
Yeah, there were parallels there. Mm-hmm. And they were around quite a bit and lovely people. I adored Carla. We all did. She was just had this sweetness about her that was just palpable. And Don, of course, was so interesting and very good at articulating their experiences, particularly with UFOs. Mm-hmm. And they were at the Mind Link. And
let's talk about the Mind Link. You've used that term twice now. What is the Mind Link?
Well, for quite a while, really since I knew Andrea, and I knew him for like 3 years, from 76 to 79, yeah. He wanted to have this major meditative experience where we would cohesively and planetarily all combine and build up to this grand occasion where we would be a channel for peace on the planet and really hoping to, in a tangible way, shift the vibration mm-hmm. that people would be able to tell. And so we had our group, but there were pockets of other groups around the planet. Now, remember, this is before cell phones and internet and all that other stuff. People still called each other on the phone and wrote letters. Yeah. So he had planned this for a really long time, and basically it was a work where you were in training. He had many people who wanted to be in it, and in the end he picked 24 of us to do it, and I was very honored to be included in that. I tried to be a clear channel and not get involved in like personality drama or any of that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. and plus I was, you know, just bowled over by this incredible opportunity. I mean, these were amazing people, you know. So, we all got together and people came from all over the world and we put them up. Some of them stayed off the property and a couple came in the school bus and stayed there. And so we had quite a regimen. We did 2 hours of yoga every morning. Then we had a meditation. We'd eat, and then in the afternoon we had the major one, where we was sort of in practice, and he would direct it slightly because he wanted to guide us all to be cohesive, mm-hmm. but he certainly wasn't dictating, and we all wrote down our experiences and took lots of notes. At least I did, and I kept them all these years, so I did have still have my little notebooks from the Mind Link,
and so this was like a one-time event.
It was a week.
A week long.
It was a week long thing and culminated in the big one.
The big one.
Yeah.
Which lasted for a few hours. How long did the big one last?
Well, time stretched during that time. That's hard to say. It was at least an hour.
Mm-hmm. And the idea, if I understand you, is the intensity of the meditation and the projection of love.
Yes.
It's to create a vibration of love so intense that it would actually shift the consciousness of the planet.
Yeah, and it was, we had no illusions that we would flip the world and everybody'd be like in love with each other after that. But we wanted to have some kind of tangible effect that could be built on. Mm-hmm. So this was like a pilot that could be replicated.
It seems to me we could use more of that today.
Yes, I think so.
I like the idea of the mind link. And in fact, you're really, I have to say, Heidi, I feel inspired to work with the New Thinking Aloud audience, 160,000 subscribers, and see if we can't do something similar, flood the planet with the vibration of love. It's needed now at least as much as it was needed in the 1970s, if not more.
I couldn't agree more, and who better than you to do it, sir? I think you got the chops.
Well, I don't know whether it worked or not, but I do know many people say it did work, that there were social political changes that took place that some people have suggested. In fact, I've seen previews of the documentary we spoke about earlier, in which the suggestion is that through these kinds of exercises and meditations, war was prevented in the 1970s in the Middle East. Not that there weren't wars in the Middle East, there were, but at least a particular war perhaps was prevented.
That's what I was told. Mm-hmm. And that there were other little pockets of unrest that sort of smoothed out all of a sudden. Now, not necessarily forever, but he had no illusions that we were just going to flip the world and everybody be in love with each other, and that would be the end of the story.
It would, if somebody had been sending out the most intense vibrations of love from a million people scattered all around the planet every day of the week since 1976, maybe then.
Yes.
Maybe then there would have been that kind of impact, and maybe that's what's even needed today.
Well, you know, that's happening. You've mm-hmm. got organizations like the Monroe Institute and others. There's the Shift Network on yours and yours. Yeah. It's a huge contribution. And metaphysics is more mainstream. There's more acceptance. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff Uri did way back when is actually being declassified. He was validated by the CIA, and they wrote out a thing validating him. That was declassified in 2017, I was told.
Mm-hmm.
I took his online course, and that was fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a awareness now, an acceptance of this as not all being woo-woo, and not just dismissed out of hand.
No, but I frankly think woo-woo isn't so bad either.
I like woo-woo.
I know it's a derogatory term,
right?
But sometimes it's important to see the positive side of derogatory terms, that the very thing that some people want to make the most fun of is often the most precious.
I agree. And the people that fight it are the ones that need to be in control. You know, there's a certain amount of letting go. And when you do that, then expansion is more possible. And with that kind of consciousness expansion, it feels loving to do that. That's sort of just where you naturally go.
Now let's talk about the fire.
Okay. I was asleep on the third floor. And I woke up to hear someone screaming.
And what was the date?
It was August 7th, 1978.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a dreary, humid August morning in New York State. And I heard someone yelling my name. And I was kind of groggy. And I was like, oh, that's weird. What's going on? And then I heard screams coming from the back of the house. And I was like, wait a minute. That was from the second floor where these people stayed, you know. So I got up and I went over to the window and I looked down. There was smoke pouring out of the bathroom on the second floor below me. And Don Elkins was on the porch in the front of the house screaming my name, screaming for me to jump out the window from the third floor. And I was like, whoa, you know, this is happening kind of fast. What's going on? And so I had to think about it a second, and I just said, okay, and just I was in this summer nightgown, and I grabbed my purse and car keys and everything and tried to go out and go down the stairs inside the house. And I got about halfway there, and I was hit with this nasty smoke. So I went back in my room, and I was like, okay. So then I thought for a second. I put sneakers on, and gathered myself together and said, all right, we're going to do it now. Because there wasn't flames up there at that time. And so I tried again. And this time it was worse. I couldn't even see the stairs. I wasn't sure the stairs were there anymore. Because I didn't know the mix of flame and smoke. It was hard to see. And it was toxic. It was awful. So I ran back in my room and I was like, whoa. And for a minute, I thought about just sitting down and thinking out what else to bring. And I was getting a little groggy. And this primal feeling inside me came up and said, get out now. And I just went over to the window and knocked plants out of the way and threw open that window. And I was balancing on the edge to, you know, and Don was telling me to jump. And it was scary because the windows had gotten knocked out. And
he was like out on the front lawn or something?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
This is the same Don who was involved in the raw channeling.
That's right, Don Elkins. Yep. He was visiting us. Mm-hmm. And he and Jaime had gone out for breakfast mm-hmm. and come back. Jaime Del Rio. Space Kid also.
One of the Space Kids.
From Mexico.
Uh-huh.
He's a lovely guy. Mm-hmm. And of course, he was a big part of the Pachita Project.
We haven't talked about the Pachita Project yet. I think we might want to save that for another interview.
Okay.
But that's another amazing adventure. And Jaime himself, as I recall, had very unusual psychokinetic talents.
Yes, and he was working on energy devices. He had worked with Andrea years before, although he was young. He's about my age, maybe a little younger. So anyway, I just finally held my breath and jumped as far out as I could away from the windows. I landed on the porch and I ricocheted back and whacked my neck really badly, but... Mm-hmm. First, I thought I was really hurt, but then the adrenaline kicked in and I just got up. And meanwhile, Don had put a ladder up to the porch and I ran down it like a flight of stairs. And that's when I saw the other people from the second floor running around the side of the house. So we all got out.
You all got out, but people could have been killed. You could have been killed.
The fire marshal had written a statement saying that he felt I had between 15 and 20 minutes left before I was poisoned.
Mm-hmm. By the smoke.
Yeah, it was very toxic.
And I gather you also learned about that time from the fire department that this was an arson.
Yes, it came up. We had, I think they said, 120 firemen from all over the county to get this thing out. And they put it out fairly quickly. It was an old house with heavy beams, well made. And they said that it would be able to be rebuilt, and eventually it was.
And then, I gather, eventually torn down.
Yeah, it was. It was an insurance office for a while, but then this townhouse development crept up all around it, mm-hmm. and finally they bought it, and in 2020 it was torn down.
So it no longer exists.
No, but you know what's fun? There was a stone wall across the front of the property, mm-hmm. a low one that the fencing was on, and I was there last fall for a different reason. And so, of course, I went by there. And it was, you know, 87 Hawks Avenue was the address. And right on the edge of the wall, they still have the 87 letters tucked into that low wall, but everything else is gone.
Well, it's interesting. Hawks Avenue.
Yes.
and you have the archetype of Horus, hawk god. It seems to be very active in Puharich's world.
Yes. Yes, hawks were. And when we traveled, we often saw hawks that just would appear and sit and stare at us, like on my trip to drive to Mexico, that kind of thing. So hawks were very symbolic in general.
And they are. My book, The Roots of Consciousness, published in 1975, has a hawk symbol throughout the book, based on, of course, my awareness at that point of the significance of the hawk in the Puharich and Geller saga.
Right. Right. And we have briefly had a newsletter after the Mind Link, mm-hmm. Because we were planning on going to devotion to start a community.
Mm-hmm.
And that was called Droppings from 87 Hawks.
Oh, Droppings.
We thought that was pretty funny.
Well, but this fire changed everything.
Yes, it did.
For one thing, I understand that some of the people from that era who were with you at that time in the house, running away, getting out of the fire, they want no part of this. They just, you don't communicate with them anymore.
No, and it was farther, more widespread than that. Mm-hmm. You have quite a few people from the Mind Link or beyond or whatever who really don't want to talk about their involvement with Andre anymore. They're terrified.
Because it seemed as if some arsonists, people who were willing to commit arson and even murder, were out to get Andrea Puharic, or at least the Space Kids. Because Puharic was not even in the country.
No, he was in Mexico. And they wrote that it was clear from the way they did it. They turned the gas jets on the oven. They lit the fire in two separate places, the kitchen and the front, and the idea was to kill everyone in the house.
There were rags soaked in
toxic, flammable stuff, mm-hmm. placed at the bottom of the staircase, mm-hmm. and then drizzled down. This stuff was drizzled down, and the same in the back kitchen. So those were the two entrances, and the idea was that no one would get out.
Yeah. And we should also mention, as part of the record, that Puharic himself believed that the CIA was behind this.
Yeah, it was a long journey. And of course, I was out of the loop for a long time. You know, all I knew was that someone had tried to kill me. The fire marshal came up and said, basically said, this was a professional arson. Do you know anybody who might want to kill you? And of course, that was blinding, because at that point, we didn't know that. And they let the dog in. The dog was found dead inside the house. So it's difficult to pinpoint that. He did hear from Don Elkins, kept in touch with the fire marshal, apparently, for a while. And also in Memories of a Maverick, the book that was written by Andre's second wife, there's a lot of this chronicled.
That book, incidentally, is hard to find, but you can download a copy and read it from Uri Geller's website.
Yes, I still have a paper copy, but yes, it's free to read, and mm-hmm. it's very well documented. Mm-hmm. I'm in the latter part of it, you know, myself. I'm not named in person. But I'm the one that called Andre in Mexico and told him about the fire and told him he needed to come back.
Yeah.
And that was a very strange phone call, as you might imagine.
Well, it's fair to say, wouldn't it be, Heidi, that this event that took place over almost half a century ago has permanently changed your life?
Yeah, it really did. You know, I didn't feel safe. I knew someone had tried to kill me for meditating. As I say, the CIA murdered for meditating, you know.
It doesn't add up, does it?
No, we were no threat to anyone. But I really think the point was to intimidate Andrea. They had hoped to burn down all his research, because remember, this was before computers. Everything was in file cabinets all over the place. And kill his assistants and the space kids that were there. And intimidate people so no one would work with him again, and he would be under their command, because that's what they wanted. He was a brilliant mind. They didn't necessarily want to kill him, but they wanted to control him.
That's the way he saw things.
Yes.
I mean, it's very hard for you or I or his second wife, who was no longer with him at that time, to be able to judge these things. But Andrea himself was the closest. And I remember speaking to him some years after that event, and he was very clear with me. He didn't mince words. He said, yeah, the CIA burned my house down.
I heard him say the same words the last time I saw him in New York in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I didn't know anything for a really long time, so it was very hard. I disappeared into Europe a year later and just wanted to vanish and not have to think about it and not feel like I was being tracked. I had been staying with my parents, and their phone had gotten tapped initially because Andrea, that was the contact, and I didn't want that for them. And I just vanished into Europe for a few months, and it really was helpful for my state of mind to do that, to travel all over and just be a free spirit again.
But if I recall correctly from your book, you did spend time in the aftermath of the fire trying to rescue things and to salvage as much as possible and to help clean up the property. You didn't leave the premises immediately.
No, well, I grabbed on the next day we were able to go back. The fire marshal took us back in to get some belongings because they didn't actually burn down the house. Most of the damage was on the bottom floor. Mm-hmm. So all of the stuff, all of Andrea's work, all of his file cabinets full of stuff had this nasty coat of soot on them, but they were not destroyed. Mm-hmm. And that is because Jaime and Don were having breakfast. They were going to go buy Don a new watch band. And all of a sudden, they looked at each other and got up and paid the bill and drove right back to the house.
They had an intuition that they needed to get back to the house.
Yes. So I say in my book that I was saved by their telepathy mm-hmm. and ours, you know.
And as I understand it, the local newspaper there in Ossining reported that the fire was caused by arson, but no one was ever arrested.
No, there were two articles, and they called me. They got my phone number. I'm not sure, and I wouldn't tell them my name or anything. The first article was the fire happened. The second article, very short, was that it was deemed an arson. Nothing ever again, and no one was ever charged.
How did Andrea take it? He was in Mexico at the time.
Well, he was shocked, of course, but he was also trying to remain calm because he knew we were traumatized. You know, he wasn't. He felt terrible about us being there and having this happen. everybody says, oh, they tried to kill Andrea. No, they didn't. They could have gotten him if they wanted to. They knew what they were doing. Mm-hmm. It was going to be wider than that. They wanted his brain to still be functioning. But
and they were willing to sacrifice the lives of innocent young people. Yeah. How many people were in the house at that time?
Who were actually in the house, three, but there were five of us on property.
In other words, Don and
Jaime
had already gone out for breakfast.
So it was me and two other roommates.
Yeah.
They were on the second floor. I was the only one on the third floor.
And obviously, you know, they had come into the house. They had every reason to know that people were there.
They had surmised, the fire marshals, that they'd been watching the place for a while. Mm-hmm. And that they decided to do it when Jaime and Don left.
And as I recall in the book, Memories of a Maverick, they go into even more detail as to exactly how this arson took place.
Yeah, it's detailed quite. But I also talked to him. I mean, the fire marshal was on site and said these things to us. Mm-hmm. And then he said, you know, there'll be an official report made. And there was. And. Mm-hmm. So it was terrifying. You know, here you are. You just had the mind link. You're working for peace. I'd come back from the Pachita Project, and we were fixing the house up to sell. And, you know, it just completely turned my world upside down, as you might imagine.
And I gather that marked the end of the Space Kids Project.
From what I understand, at one point when he lived in Mexico, he had a compound down there where he had some of that going on again. Mm-hmm. He never stopped working. I reread Memories of a Maverick recently. Mm-hmm. Just it was a helpful resource because this is a long time ago. And they talk about that in the book a bit, but I wasn't part of that. So
the people who were around at the time of the fire, most of them just wanted to be as far away from anything having to do with Andrea Puharich as possible.
And that carries on to this day.
And you were sort of in that camp as well. I mean, your communications with him, as you say, began to taper off at that point.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I had to survive and start a new life and get a job and, you know, take care of myself. Mm-hmm. And move on as best I could.
So you helped fix up the house to prepare it for sale. And
well, that was before the fire.
Before the fire. You were already engaged in that.
Yeah.
After the fire, did you continue?
The only thing I did was go back to feed the cat. Mm-hmm. We had a cat that was there, and nobody took them, and my parents didn't want it at the house for whatever reason. And so I went back and would feed her and cuddle her. So it was kind of creepy because I was going back in the house, had this sort of sinister feel, you know, was just sitting there and you could still smell the smoke a bit and all. And mm-hmm. eventually a neighbor adopted the cat and that was lovely. So I didn't have to go back.
And you took off for Europe.
I did in the next spring. I saved up money. I started a house cleaning business so I could go in and just, you know, set my price and not deal with people and do it when they weren't home and be totally under the radar in terms of being in the public, and saved up my money and got a Eurail pass and a knapsack and off I went.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very healing experience.
Well, in looking back on it, I gather that overall you have very fond memories of that period of your life.
I do, and I focus on that because if I focus on the bad part, I will never be able to function as an adult anymore. I mean, it's still, as I say in my book, the idea that my government thought of me as completely disposable when we were actively working in peace and wanted to murder me for meditating is heartbreaking and remains so. I never got any answers.
As well it should. But to be fair, since we've talked about this already, I'm under the impression it's not that the CIA wanted to stop the space kids and stop the mind link. They were concerned about Puharich for a different reason.
I think it was a combination mm-hmm. because you know, they were in contact with Uri Geller, and he was working with doing different projects. So here Andrea had these different people that he was, you know, bringing along to get to not the same things that Uri did, but also be able to do healing work and other things at the same magnitude. And the property was being sold, and he was moving to Mexico to study Pachita. I don't think they wanted to have to keep track of everybody. I think part of it was a financial decision. Kill two birds with one stone. Get rid of all these people. We don't want to have to track them. Spend the money to have to track what they're doing away from Andrea.
Now, if I recall correctly, by 1977, there had already been, I think they were called the church hearings in Congress about government-sponsored assassinations and the CIA overstepping its boundary. And by that time, Congress had passed laws very explicitly making the sort of thing that you're describing illegal.
I don't know. I don't know that that necessarily stops people.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got some pretty big egos in the hierarchy of the CIA who mm-hmm. probably did not want to be defied. I don't have answers. All I know that I was a young woman. I was 24 years old. I'd almost died. I was being terrorized. And I had to think about my own survival. And Andrea, basically, after a while, didn't want to be in contact with any of us that were in the fire because, you know, his rationale was that it would be safer for us to not have contact with him. Mm. So we dealt with him through Solveig,
his secretary
Clark, who was worked as helped him in a secretarial mode, but she helped organize.
If I gather from your book, Solveig was a volunteer who functioned as his secretary.
Yeah, she actually worked for Revlon, and she lived in New York City. But she had been with him for decades, and mm-hmm. she helped organize everything. Mm-hmm. She organized the mind link. She's the one who sent out all the paperwork and the invitations and did all that stuff.
All right.
She was a big presence.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe she went to Egypt with Andrea in the pyramid. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't just a secretary. She was heavily involved in all this. And she felt it was her mission to help Andrea. And she was very clear on that.
So after the fire, she continued?
She did.
Mm-hmm. And you maintained contact with her?
Yes, because there were also insurance issues.
Mm-hmm.
We'd lost all our belongings, and they wanted to at least try and replace some of that stuff. I was given a brand new typewriter. My typewriter was destroyed. Mm-hmm. It took quite a while. It was sometime in 1979 that all went mm-hmm. through. As you might imagine, that was a complicated case, given that it was called an arson. I wasn't really in the loop of any of that. I think they really felt like they needed to shield us from it to some degree because it was a traumatic event.
Well, now the title of your book is The Making of a Psychic, but I'm almost under the impression that the story suggests the opposite, that you, after the fire, you didn't want to pursue psychic matters. Your career direction shifted quite a bit.
I went through a phase where I really wanted to get rid of it. I did not want to know anything about anybody. And just felt like I'd almost paid the ultimate price for doing this when my intentions were so honorable. It was devastating. And it haunted me. And I never got any answers until I read about them in Andrea's book and, you know, this kind of thing, and a little bit from Edith, because she stayed in contact with him. But I think they were trying to protect me because it was a devastating event. So just for my own mental health, I had to detach from this.
So maybe the fairest way to appraise it is to say you got caught up in somebody else's drama.
That's exactly how it feels. Because we really tried hard to keep our thing pure. You know, we didn't drink, we didn't smoke pot, we didn't do anything, and we weren't a bunch of brainwashed zombies that, you know, it was just wasn't like that. You know, there was no, it wasn't orgies. There was, you know, people like to assign all kinds of things to these sort of organizations. It just wasn't like that. We meditated at noon every day. We had a set schedule of things that we did. And, you know, Andre was quite organized. So we had duties that we did. I did a lot of the reading, writing help with him and that sort of thing.
And in terms of the community of space kids, how large was it altogether?
Oh, boy. Well, let's see, the Mind Link was 24 people. And then there were people who could come for various reasons all over the planet. A couple hundred.
A couple hundred people. And did you stay in touch with that community at all?
Not for quite a while. But then, you now that there's internet, you can Google and see if they're, first of all, they're still on the planet, because this is a long time ago. Not everybody's still alive. Yeah. And to see what they're doing. And I've contacted one or two, but they didn't want anything to do with it. And I made sure in my book to disguise everyone's names and descriptions. That's the only fair thing to do, because people are still scared to this day.
So I guess it would be fair to say that the Space Kids Project really dissipated as a result of the fire.
Absolutely. Yeah. His. Now, there are other groups around because, you know, you can go to Monroe Institute and learn how to bend a spoon. These kind of phenomenons, and then there's the Remote Viewing Project, which is a whole other thing that was a military program. And all those things are becoming more mainstream. So you have different groups doing some of the same things, and it's not so, you know, taboo anymore. But our cluster of people dispersed permanently.
Well, let's talk for a moment before we close our interview about Andrea's interest in the ELF, extremely low frequency electromagnetic signals that can penetrate the oceans, that can travel long distances. ELF signals can circle the planet and can affect human physiology. Andrea felt that this was an issue that the government needed to be concerned about. I think you told me he actually met with the President of the United States about it.
Yeah, and that is actually Memories of a Maverick. All that's documented quite well. Yeah, and he was, you know, basically screaming about this to, you know, scientific people who would from all over the world. I mean, he was going to conferences all the time and was very much in demand as a speaker, of course, that this was something we really needed to pay attention to, and that Tesla's, you know, worst fear was coming true, that these were going to be used for nefarious purposes. In the beginning, he said that the Russians had used ELF waves to change the weather all over the planet. And they were pumping it using the Earth as a resonator. And they had the best growing season they ever had that year. Meanwhile, havoc for other countries and places around the globe. So it was a test case to see how much they could mess with the weather to help themselves, but also as a power trip to influence countries they wanted to dominate.
So he basically felt that we were falling behind the Russians in ELF research.
Absolutely. We did not have a program at that time, he said. And he was desperately trying to get one developed. And they told him to shut up. They weren't ready. Stop. Knock it off.
So
and he didn't listen, so they swatted him good.
The CIA was unhappy with the fact that he was out there publicly arguing that we needed to have an ELF research project.
Exactly.
Because but they didn't want to do it themselves either at that point.
I don't think they were organized enough to do it, and something like that would be quite something to take on. So, you know, I wasn't totally in the loop about this. He tried not to scare us with things, too, because that's not what we were there for. But, we go to conferences, and he would take papers. Now, when we were in Pachitas in Mexico, I went up to California briefly for a friend's wedding, and I brought a copy of TMT Tesla Magnifying Transmitter, which is about ELF waves. I brought a copy of that to Michael Phillips' office in L.A.
The producer
of Close Encounters.
Close Encounters, yeah.
And I don't know what happened to that, but Andrea was told later on that there were copies of that book floating around, and the CIA was very concerned about what was in it, and there was going to be pressure to suppress that.
Also, I gather, according, I suppose, to Memories of a Maverick, the book, that eventually, long after the fire, the CIA approached Puharich again.
That is in the book, and it's also in Edith's notes, in her notebooks. It's right there. And when I was researching my book to refresh my memory, oh my goodness, she had a conversation with him and said, "So, do you think you're safe now?" And he told the story, it's written right in there, of how, and I think it was in 1983, he was approached for a meeting, and they were getting that going. They had already made some steps on doing that, and they wanted to put together an organization, and they wanted Andre to head it. And he wanted him in charge. And Andre's reply was something to the effect of, "Go, whatever." And I'm not going to work for thieves, murderers, and, you know, so on.
He had had enough of affiliation with the intelligence community.
Well, he's like, "You burned down my house and tried to kill all the space kids, and now you want me to work for you? Never."
Well, Heidi, this has been a most illuminating conversation about a lost chapter in the history of American parapsychology. Very few people know about all of this. Well, I didn't know about it until recently.
Well, I appreciate with your patience, because it's a long time ago, and the book helped my memory, but still, you know, I got to reach back there to bring all this stuff to the forefront.
Well, I am delighted that you have published much of this story in your book, The Making of a Psychic. I want to recommend that book our viewers. And also, there's a whole other chapter of this story that we haven't touched upon in this interview. We'll come back now that you're here with me in Albuquerque, and we're going to talk about the adventures you had in Mexico with Puharich, working with the amazing Mexican healer Pachita, who coincidentally, was the subject of an interview that we just released about a week ago with Alex Gomez Marin, talking about the Mexican neuropsychologist Jacobo Greenberg, who also studied carefully Pachita and was amazed, just amazed by things she could do that seemed to completely defy our conventional notions of space and time.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good documentation on her, which is really helpful.
And you have some firsthand reports yourself we'll be talking about.
I was there.
Well, Heidi, thank you so much for being with me today.
My pleasure, Jeffrey.
And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that, in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the new Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is There Life After Death? New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.